Audible.com, home to over 60,000 audiobooks and more. Details on how to download an audiobook, including the Thalia Book Club and selected short series, are at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
You wanted to write because you had stories to tell. You wanted to write about the surprising openness of people in America. How eagerly they told you about their mother fighting cancer, about their sister-in-law's preemie, and the kinds of things that one should hide or should reveal only to the family members who wished them well. You wanted to write about the way people left so much food on their plates and crumpled a few dollar bills down as though it was an offering, expiation for the wasted food. You wanted to write about the rich people who wore shabby clothes and tattered sneakers, who looked like the night watchman in front of the large compounds in Lagos. You wanted to write that rich Americans were thin and poor Americans were fat.
You're listening to Kondola Rashad, reading from Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's story, The Thing Around Your Neck, which we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. This is a very special edition of Selected Shorts, friends, devoted to visual art, to literary works connected to or inspired by a remarkable exhibition of photography at the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York City, an evening we created in collaboration with the Department of Photography of the Met and also its college group at the Met. The exhibition was entitled Looking In, Robert Frank's The Americans. Here in the WNYC studio with me to tell you about the exhibition is our friend, the curator of the Met's Department of Photography, Jeff Rosenheim. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you so much for having me. The exhibition at the Met celebrated Robert Frank's great body of photographs called The Americans and the publication 50 years ago of his book of the same name. The first piece on the program is by Allen Ginsberg. It's entitled Sunflower Sutra. Ginsberg and Frank met in the late 1950s and became fast friends. Please be advised, there is rough language in the poem, and here now is Sunflower Sutra by Allen Ginsberg, read by Isaiah.
I walked on the banks of the tin-canned banana dock and sat down under the huge shade of a Southern Pacific locomotive to look at the sunset over the Box House Hills and cry. Jack Kerouac sat beside me on a busted, rusty iron pole. Companion, we thought the same thoughts of the soul, bleak and blue and sad-eyed, surrounded by the gnarled steel roots of trees of machinery. The oily water on the river mirrored the red sky. Sun sank on top of final Frisco peaks. No fish in that stream, no hermit in those mounts, just ourselves, rheumy-eyed and hungover like old bums on the riverbank, tired and wily. Look at the sunflower, he said. There was a dead gray shadow against the sky, big as a man, sitting dry on top of a pile of ancient sawdust. I rushed up, enchanted. It was my first sunflower. Memories of Blake, my visions, Harlem and hells of the eastern rivers, bridges clanking, Joe's greasy sandwiches, dead baby carriages, black treadless tires, forgotten and unretreaded, the poem of the riverbank, condoms and pots, steel knives, nothing stainless, only the dank muck and the razor-sharp artifacts passing into the past. And the gray sunflower, poised against the sunset, crackly, bleak, and dusty with the smut and smog and smoke of olden locomotives in its eye. Corolla of bleary spikes, pushed down and broken like a battered crown, seeds fallen out of its face, soon to be toothless mouth of sunny air, sun rays obliterated on its hairy head like a dried wire spider web. Leaves stuck out like arms out of the stem, gestures from the sawdust root, broke pieces of plaster fallen out of the black twigs, a dead fly in its ear. Unholy battered old thing you were, my sunflower. Oh, my soul, I loved you then. The grime was no man's grime, but death and human locomotives, all that dress of dust, that veil of darkened railroad skin, that smog of cheek, that eyelid of black misery, that sooty hand or phallus or protuberance of artificial worse than dirt, industrial, modern, all that civilization spotting your crazy golden crown. And those blear thoughts of death and dusty, loveless eyes and ends and withered roots below in the home pile of sand and sawdust, rubber dollar bills, skin of machinery, the guts and innards of the weeping, coughing car, the empty, lonely tin cans with their rusty tongues, alack. What more could I name? The smoked ashes of some cigar, the cuts of wheelbarrows and the milky breasts of cars, worn-out asses out of chairs and sphincters of dynamos, all these entangled in your mummied roots. And you there, standing before me in the sunset, all your glory in your form, a perfect beauty of a sunflower, a perfect, excellent, lovely sunflower existence, a sweet natural eye to the new hip moon, woke up alive and excited, grasping in the sunset shadow, sunrise, golden monthly breeze. How many flies buzz round you, innocent of your grime, while you curse the heavens of the railroad and your flower's soul? Poor dead flower. When did you forget you were a flower? When did you look at your skin and decide you were an impotent, dirty old locomotive, the ghost of a locomotive, the specter and shade of a once powerful, mad American locomotive? You were never no locomotive, sunflower. You were a sunflower. And you, locomotive, you are a locomotive, forget me not. So I grabbed up the skeleton-thick sunflower and stuck it at my side like a scepter and deliver my sermon to my soul and Jack's soul, too, and anyone who'll listen. We are not our skin of grime. We are not our dread, bleak, dusty, imageless locomotive. We are all beautiful golden sunflowers inside. We're blessed by our own seed and golden, hairy, naked accomplishment bodies growing into mad, black, formal sunflowers in the sunset, spied on by our eyes under the shadow of the mad locomotive riverbank, sunset, Frisco, hilly, tin can, evening, sit-down vision.
That was Allen Ginsberg's poem Sunflower Sutra, read by Isaiah Sheffer. During the exhibition, the Metropolitan Museum's College Group and Symphony Space invited writers, college students, to come to the museum and to respond to one of 10 of Robert Frank's photographs. Two winners were selected. And here is Alyssa Hudson speaking about her response to Robert Frank's photograph, Funeral, St. Helena, South Carolina, an image from 1955.
What interested me in this picture in particular is the photograph is of a group of African-American men at a funeral standing around a bunch of Cadillacs. The photograph is black and white, so that brings out sort of the dust and the feel of what I imagine to be a hot summer day. The expressions on their faces are particularly interesting. One man's sort of look is tender and curious, and that inspired me to wonder who is the person that died here, what is going on, and it's just really a beautiful photograph. The story is called The Death of Jim Taylor, and it explores racial problems in South Carolina in 1955.
That was contest winner Alyssa Hudson speaking about her story, The Death of Jim Taylor. It will now be read by Boyd Gaines. Please note that the photograph can be seen by visiting selectedshorts.org.
Beneath mustard-colored cranes and dump trucks filled with dust, The earth opened itself up to the man torn in two. The workers said that the garbage truck had pinned the man down, splitting him in half. The man snapped like a boy's toy train set, his body bursting evenly, delicately to the ground. That evening, the workers went home, told their wives and children about the accident. Suddenly, the man's death became the total of his life. He became a fable in and of himself, not as an example of mortality, but of pure recklessness. He had not given enough attention to his surroundings. He had not grounded himself in his work, they said. Had he been more careful around the machinery, they murmured over greasy chicken dinners or under hot pool table lamps to their sons or to their bartenders. I always knew he was a careless old man, that poor son of a bitch. What the workers did not say, but simultaneously observed, was that his accident was somehow different than others they had seen. The nature of his death was, in a way, gentler. He had come apart softly. The paper said his name was Jim Taylor, but no one paid much attention. He was black. I could not stop thinking about the way he died. I was awake at night revisiting the accident I didn't see. I envisioned the men at the construction site shouting as they tried to turn off the garbage truck. The machine hovering over the man, pressing against his broken body with an unearthly force. The men pounding boots to dirt, lifting him from beneath the truck. But he was already dead. Late at night, I'd drive to the construction site and imagine the man on ordinary days. And I'd watch him from my car window, shoulders heavy against the sky, as he pulled back hard the truck's lever. Some nights I'd fall asleep in my Cadillac and I'd wake up thinking that he was still there, hauling dust. I wanted to go to the funeral, even though I had never met him. I knew I'd stick out, me, white skin, white Cadillac, watching black skin, black suits, listening to the cries of a preacher underneath the tender bosom of a sweltering St. Helena summer. I imagined the gravedigger opening deep the taut, wet soil with a sense of urgency. But I knew not to go. The folks at work would say that was no place for a white man. Sometimes I still think of Jim Taylor and the funeral that I never went to. And I imagine Jim Taylor in the casket, a wet fish on a cutting board, slipping into darkness. Thank you.
We'll now hear from Bianca Galvez discussing her story, Barbara Stanwyck, It's Your Time to Shine. It's a response to Robert Frank's photograph, Elevator Miami Beach, also from 1955.
I chose this photo because there was just something about the way the unnamed girl was looking, and I just wanted to write about maybe a few minutes at her job. I tried to appropriate the sort of quintessential 1950s voice of a working girl.
That was Bianca Galvez speaking about her story, Barbara Stanwyck, It's Your Time to Shine, a response to Robert Frank's photograph, Elevator, Miami Beach, from 1955. It will now be read by Condola Rashad. Please note that the photograph can be seen by visiting selectedshorts.org.
It's one of those lousy days. Squalls of hot rain the size of barnacles smacking the sidewalk, where the girls think it's too much of a chore to head out for hamburgers after work. If Frank Steinhoff were here, he'd slink his hand around my waist, reel me in, and say they're just small. Because he goes on like that. He's the only boy who I can stand to go on like that. I look straight ahead at the paneled walls, fussed over and shining a deep corroded brass. The manager keeps running off on how I've got the loony bin look, but he knows no one's got the smarts to take a marvelous job like this. A couple step in. The old man with a stump of cigar pressed to his lips, pushing his missus over left, and the car doors rumble shut. I say the obligatory evening, folks, pull the lever and head for the sub-main floor. The missus has a crisp pair of show tickets, and the old man is plucking car keys like a set of dry matchsticks. It's not difficult to see their old money. Camel hair top coats, heavy silverware, the works. Frank Steinoff has a family like that up on Bell Harbor. But I've seen him on Biscayne wearing dungarees and creeping around his fellows, dingy, brutal, pretending they live in a dump. Nancy thinks he's funny looking with those lopsided ears. The right lobe nicked along the coast when he swam out and slipped off the narrow shelf, but he's a real swimmer. Sleek as a dolphin, with gusty man arms snubbing the purling claws of sea. It's those shrimp enchiladas, boss, he says. He's a nice guy, I tell you. Sure, I'd bring Frank home sometime, but every MIMO on the Miami shore has a corny bolt of roof shooting past the driveway like greased lightning that he'd be bored in a minute. Lady, the man says to me, I said we're getting off at the lobby. I mumble an excuse and jockey the car up the floor. Some people can't relax. The late shows aren't starting, and the only place open is a counter and booth restaurant that serves everything with Tabasco sauce. A group of boys walk in with wet robes and dots of zinc salve on their noses. One of them is Frank's friend with a combed back ducktail, but he doesn't recognize me. He's got this yellow balloon on a wooden stick and lobs it in my hair, and I tell him to knock it off, but he's just having a ball. Barbara Stanwyck, he says to me, it's your time to shine. They get off on the fifth floor, knocking into each other, and it takes all I've got to keep from running off on how Frank will slug him the next time I see him. Really, these hams have nothing on Frank. I stand a little straighter and smile, because I know what I'm talking about.
That was Condola Rashad reading Bianca Galvez's story, Barbara Stanwyck, It's Your Time to Shine. After a short break, we'll hear stories by Alexander Heyman and Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. The final two stories on this program portray two immigrant additions to the American landscape and populace depicted by Robert Frank's photographs. We'll start with Alexander Heyman's story, Good Living. It's performed by the Broadway and film actor Boyd Gaines.
Back in the days of the war in Bosnia, I was surviving in Chicago by selling magazine subscriptions door to door. My employers thought that my Bosnian accent, clearly manufactured in the nether area of other cultures, was quirky and therefore stimulant to the shopping instincts of suburban Americans. I was desperate at the time, what with the war and displacement, so I shamelessly exploited any smidgen of pity I could detect in lonely housewives and grumpy retirees whose doors I knocked at. Many of them were excited by my very presence at their doorstep, as I was living evidence of the American dream. Here I was, overcoming adverse circumstances in a new country, much like the forebears of the future subscriber, presently signing the check and wistfully relating the saga of the ancestral transition to America. But I had too much of a dramatic foreign accent for the prime subscription-selling turf of the North Shore suburbs, where people quaintly smothered by the serenity of wealth, regularly read numismatic news, and bought a lifetime subscription to Life Extension. Instead, I was deployed in the working-class suburbs bordering with steel mill complexes and landfills, and populated with people who, unlike the denizens of the North Shore, did not think that I coveted what they had, because they did not exactly want it themselves. My best turf was Blue Island, way down Western Avenue, where addresses had 5-digit numbers, as though the town was far back of the long line of people waiting to enter downtown paradise. I got along pretty well with the Blue Islanders. They could recognize quickly the indelible lousiness of my job. They offered me food and water. Once, I nearly got laid. They did not waste their time contemplating the purpose of human life. Their years were spent as a tale is told, slowly, steadily, approaching the inexorable end. In the meantime, all they wanted was to live, wisely use what little love they had accrued, and endure life with the anesthetic help of television and magazines. I happened to be in their neighborhood to offer the magazines. A smokestack of the garbage incinerator, complete with sparks flying upward, loomed over the town like a church spire. Perhaps that was why the deciduous leaves in Blue Island died so abundantly and beautifully, its streets thickly covered with yellow, orange, ochre, russet layers. One day I walked over a dry carpet of honey-colored leaves up to a dusty porch littered with disintegrating sheets of coupons. A brushy black cat did not move as I walked by. A wooden figure of the Virgin Mary hung stiffly by the bell. Someone shouted, "Come in!" before I rang, and in I walked into a cavernous dark room reeking of over-curdled milk and beeswax tapers. On the couch, in its center, sat a small priest. The solemn attire, the white collar, the silver cross pendant, his toy feet barely reaching the floor. His face and bald dome were blighted with red blotches and flaking skin. In his right hand, he had a glass of scotch, the half-empty bottle on the coffee table in front of him, surrounded by the rubble of newspapers and snack bags. On his pot-belly ledge around the cross, there were potato chip crumbles. "What can I do you for?" he said, and belched. "Excuse me, what can I do for you?" He pointed at the armchair across the coffee table, so I sat down. A salesman's job consists largely of mindless repetition of prefabricated phrases. Thus, I offered him a wide selection of magazines that covered all areas of contemporary living. There was a magazine for everyone, whether his interest be in astronomy or self-betterment or gardening. I could also offer a wide variety of titles for a contemporary Christian reader: Christianity Today, Christian Professional, God's Word Today. "Where are you from?" he asked, and took a large sip from the glass. The color of the scotch rhymed with the leaves outside. "Bosnia." "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers," he slurred, "for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." I nodded and suggested a few magazines that would open a new horizon for him in archaeology or medicine or science. He shook his head, frowning, as though he could not believe in my existence. "Have you lost anyone close to you in the war? Anyone you loved?" "Some," I said, and lowered my head, suggesting intense soul pain. "It must have been hard for you." "It hasn't been easy." Abruptly, he turned his head toward the dark door in the back of the room and yelled, "Michael! Michael, come here and see someone who is really suffering!"
Come and meet an actual human being. Michael stepped into the room, buttoning up, the impeccably white shirt closing in on a chest smooth and hairless. He was blonde and blue-eyed, incongruously handsome in the Blue Island dreariness, sporting the square jaw of the American movie star. The young man here is from Bosnia. Do you have any idea where Bosnia is, Michael? Michael said nothing and strolled over to the coffee table, throwing his shoulders model-like. He dug up a cigarette from the coffee table wreckage and walked out, leaving a wake of anger behind. He smokes, the priest said plaintively. He breaks my heart. Smoking is bad, I said. But he works out a lot, the priest said. Absent in spirit, but present in body. I had a selection of magazines just for Michael, I said. Men's Health, Shape, Self, Body and Soul, all of them covering a wide range of interests, workout regimens, fitness tips, diets, etc. Michael, the priest hollered, would you like a subscription to Body and Soul? You! Michael screamed back. The priest finished his scotch and pushed himself awkwardly up from the couch to reach the bottle. I was tempted to help him. If there were a magazine called Selfishness, he grumbled, Michael would be editor-in-chief. He refilled the glass and returned into the depth of the couch. He scratched his dome, and a flock of skinflakes fluttered up in its orbit. Michael wants to be an actor, you see. He is nothing if not vanity and vexation, the priest said. But he has only managed to be a fluffer in the odd adult movie. And to tell you the truth, I cannot see a future in fluffing for him. It was time for me to go. I was experienced enough to recognize the commencement of an unsolicited confession. I had stood up and left in the middle of a confession before, no doubt adding to the confessor's flow of tears, because it had been the prudent thing to do. But this time I could not leave, perhaps because the drama was titillatingly unresolved, or because the priest was so minuscule and weak, whole parchments peeling off his forehead. Having been often pitied, I savored pitying someone else. I've known Michael since he was a boy, but now he thinks he can go off on his own. It is not good that the man shall be alone. It is not good. Michael appeared out of the room in the back, his hair immaculately combed but still quivering in exasperation. He stormed past us and left the house, slamming the door behind him. The priest finished off the scotch in the glass in one big gulp. We all do fade as a leaf, he said, and threw the glass toward the coffee table. It dropped on the top of the mess and rolled down, off the table, out of sight. It was time for me to go. I started getting up. Do you know who St. Thomas Aquinas was? He said, raising his finger as though about to preach. Yes, of course I know, I said. When he was a young man, his family did not want him to devote his life to the church, so they sent a beautiful maiden to tempt him out of it, and he chased her away with a torch. He stared at me for a very long moment, as though waiting for a confirmation of my understanding. But it never came. Understanding was not my job. Be not righteous overmuch, he said, fumbling the word overmuch. I never had a torch. The door flung open and Michael charged back in.
I sank into the chair as he walked to the priest and stood above him, pointing his index finger at him, shaking it. His jaw jutted sideways with fury. "I just want to say one thing, you sick fuck," he said, a few loose hairs stuck to his sweaty brow. "I just want to say one more thing to you." We waited in the overwhelming silence, the priest closing his eyes, anticipating a punch. But Michael could not think of one more thing to say. So he finally said nothing, turned on his heel and marched out, not bothering to slam the door this time. The priest grabbed a couch pillow and started banging it against his forehead, howling and hissing in pain. I took the opportunity to slither toward the open door. "Wait!" he wailed. "I want to subscribe. I want subscription. Wait a minute." So, I signed him up for 2-plum 2-year subscriptions. His name was Father James McMahon. For the rest of the evening, I went around the neighborhood telling everybody, the old ladies, the young mothers, the cranky ex-policemen, that Father McMahon had just subscribed to American Woodworker and Good Living, wouldn't you know it? A few asked me how he seemed to be doing, and I would tell them that he had had a big fight with his young friend. And they would sigh and say, "Is that so?" And frown and subscribe to creative knitting and family fun. It was by far my best day as a magazine salesman. At the end of the shift, waiting to be picked up by the turf manager, I watched the flickering TV lights in the windows and the sparkling stars up in the sky. And I thought, I could live here. I could live here forever. This is a good place for me. Thank you.
Boyd Gaines read Alexander Heyman's Good Living. Our final story is the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's tale, The Thing Around Your Neck, and is performed by a wonderful young actress, Kondola Rashad.
You thought everybody in America had a car and a gun. And your uncles and aunts and cousins thought so too. Right after you won the American Visa lottery, they told you, in a month, you will have a big car. Soon, a big house. But don't buy a gun like those Americans. They trooped into the room in Lagos where you lived with your father and mother and 3 siblings, leaning against the unpainted walls because there weren't enough chairs to go round, to say goodbye in loud voices and tell you with lowered voices what they wanted you to send them. In comparison to the big car in the house, and possibly gun, the things they wanted were minor. Handbags and shoes and perfumes and clothes. You said, okay, no problem. Your uncle in America, who had put in the names of all your family members for the American Visa lottery, said you could stay with him until you got on your feet. He picked you up at the airport and bought you a big hot dog with yellow mustard that nauseated you. Introduction to America, he said with a laugh. He lived in a small white town in Maine in a 30-year-old house by a lake. He told you that the company he worked for had offered him a few thousand more than the average salary plus stock options because they were desperately trying to look diverse. They included a photo of him in every brochure. Even those that had nothing to do with his unit. He laughed and said the job was good and worth living in an all-white town, even though his wife had to drive an hour to find a hair salon that did black hair. The trick was to understand America, to know that America was give and take. You gave up a lot, but you gained a lot, too. He showed you how to apply for a cashier job in the gas station on Main Street, and he enrolled you in a community college where the girls had thick thighs and wore bright red nail polish and self-tanner that made them look orange. They asked you where you learned to speak English and if you had real houses back in Africa and if you'd seen a car before you came to America. They gawped at your hair. Does it stand up or fall down when you take it out of the braids? They just wanted to know. All of it stands up. How? Why? Do you use a comb? You smiled tightly when they asked those questions. Your uncle told you to expect it. A mixture of ignorance and arrogance, he called it. Then he told you how the neighbors said, a few months after he moved into the house, that the squirrels had started to disappear. They had heard that Africans ate all kinds of wild animals. You laughed with your uncle, and you felt at home in his house. His wife called you Nwane, sister, and his two school-aged children called you auntie. They spoke Igbo and ate gari for lunch, and it was like home. Until your uncle came into the cramped basement where you slept with old boxes and cartons and pulled you forcefully to him, squeezing your buttocks, moaning. He wasn't really your uncle. He was actually a brother of your father's sister's husband, not related by blood. After you pushed him away, he sat on your bed. It was his house, after all. And smiled and said you were no longer a child at 22. If you let him, he would do many things for you. Smart women did it all the time. How did you think those women back home in Lagos with well-paying jobs made it? Even women in New York City. You locked yourself in the bathroom until he went back upstairs, and the next morning you left, walking the long, windy road, smelling the baby fish in the lake. You saw him drive past. He had always dropped you off at Main Street, and he didn't honk. You wondered what he would tell his wife, why he had left, and you remembered what he said, that America was give and take. You ended up in Connecticut, in another little town, because it was the last stop of the Greyhound bus you got on. You walked into the restaurant with the bright, clean awning and said you would work for $2 less than the other waitresses. The manager, Juan, had inky black hair and smiled to show a gold tooth. He said he had never had a Nigerian employee, but all immigrants worked hard. He knew. He'd been there. He'd pay you a dollar less. But under the table, he didn't like all the taxes they were making him pay. You could not afford to go to school because now you paid rent for the tiny room with the stained carpet. Besides, the small Connecticut town didn't have a community college, and credits at the state university cost too much. So you went to the public library. You looked up course syllabi on school websites and read some of the books. Sometimes you sat on the lumpy mattress of your twin bed and thought about home. Your aunts who hawked dried fish and plantains, cajoling customers to buy and then shouting insults when they didn't. Your uncles who drank local gin and crammed their families and lives into single rooms. Your friends who had come out to say goodbye before you left, to rejoice because you won the American visa lottery, to confess their envy. Your parents who often held hands as they walked to church on Sunday mornings. The neighbors from the next room laughing and teasing them. Your father who brought back his boss's old newspapers from work and made your brothers read them. Your mother, whose salary was barely enough to pay your brother's school fees at the secondary school where teachers gave an A when someone slipped them a brown envelope. You had never needed to pay for an A. Never slipped a brown envelope to a teacher in secondary school. Still, you chose long brown envelopes to send half your month's earnings to your parents at the address of the peristatal where your mother was a cleaner. You always used the dollar notes that Juan gave you because those were crisp, unlike the tips. Every month, you wrapped the money carefully in white paper, but you didn't write a letter. There's nothing to write about. In later weeks, though, you wanted to write because you had stories to tell. You wanted to write about the surprising openness of people in America. How eagerly they told you about their mother fighting cancer, about their sister-in-law's preemie, and the kinds of things that one should hide or should reveal only to the family members who wished them well. You wanted to write about the way people left so much food on their plates and crumpled a few dollar bills down as though it was an offering, expiation for the wasted food. You wanted to write about the child who started to cry and pull at her blonde hair and push the menus off the table, and instead of the parents making her shut up, they pleaded with her. A child of perhaps 5 years old. And then they all got up and left. You wanted to write about the rich people who wore shabby clothes and tattered sneakers, who looked like the night watchman in front of the large compounds in Lagos. You wanted to write that rich Americans were thin and poor Americans were fat, and that many did not have a big house and car. You still were not sure about the guns, though, because they might have them inside their pockets. It wasn't just to your parents you wanted to write. It was also to your friends and cousins and aunts and uncles. But you could never afford enough perfumes and clothes and handbags and shoes to go around and still pay your rent on what you earned at the waitressing job. So you wrote nobody. Nobody knew where you were because you told no one. Sometimes you felt invisible and tried to walk through your room wall into the hallway. And when you bumped into the wall, it left bruises on your arms. Once, Juan asked if you had a man that hit you because he would take care of him, and you laughed a mysterious laugh. At night, something would wrap itself around your neck, something that very nearly choked you before you fell asleep. Many people at the restaurant asked when you had come from Jamaica, because they thought that every black person with a foreign accent was Jamaican. Or some who guessed that you were African told you that they loved elephants and wanted to go on a safari. So, when he asked you, in the dimness of the restaurant after you recited the daily specials, what African country you were from, you said Nigeria and expected him to say that he had donated money to fight AIDS in Botswana. But he asked you if you were Yoruba or Igbo, because you didn't have a Fulani face. You were surprised. You thought he must be a professor of anthropology at the state university, a little young in his late 20s or so, but who was to say? Igbo, you said. He asked your name and said, Akuna was pretty. He did not ask what it meant, fortunately, because you were sick of how people said, father's wealth. You mean like your father will actually sell you to a husband? He told you he had been to Ghana and Uganda and Tanzania, loved the poetry of Okoye Bitek and the novels of Amos Tutuola, and had read a lot about sub-Saharan African countries, their histories, their complexities. You wanted to feel disdain, to show it as you brought his order, because white people who liked Africa too much and those who liked Africa too little were the same, condescending. But he didn't shake his head in the superior way that Professor Cobbledick back in the Maine Community College did during a class discussion on decolonization in Africa. He didn't have that expression of Professor Cobbledick's, that expression of a person who thought himself better than the people he knew about. He came in the next day and sat at the same table, and when you asked if the chicken was okay, he asked if you had grown up in Lagos. He came in the third day and began talking before he ordered about how he had visited Bombay and now wanted to visit Lagos to see how real people lived, like in the shanty towns, because he never did any of that silly tourist stuff when he was abroad. He talked and talked, and you had to tell him it was against restaurant policy. He brushed your hand when you set the glass of water down. The fourth day when you saw him arrive, you told Juan you didn't want that table anymore. After your shift that night, he was waiting outside, earphones stuck in his ears, asking you to go out with him because your name rhymed with Hakuna Matata and The Lion King was the only Marlin movie he'd ever liked. You didn't know what The Lion King was. You looked at him in the bright light and noticed his eyes were the color of extra virgin olive oil, a greenish gold. Extra virgin olive oil was the only thing you loved, truly loved, in America. He was a senior at the state university. He told you how old he was, and you asked why he had not graduated yet. This was America, after all. It was not like back home where universities closed so often that people added 3 years to their normal course of study and lecturers went on strike after strike and still were not paid. He said he had taken a couple of years off to discover himself and travel, mostly to Africa and Asia. You asked him where he ended up finding himself, and he laughed. You did not laugh. You did not know that people could simply choose not to go to school, that people could dictate to life. You were used to accepting what life gave, writing down what life dictated. You said no the following 4 days to going out with him because you were uncomfortable with the way he looked at your face, that intense, consuming way he looked at your face that made you say goodbye to him, but also made you reluctant to walk away. And then, the fifth night, you panicked when he was not standing at the door after your shift. You prayed for the first time in a long time, and when he came up behind you and said, hey, you said yes, you would go out with him, even before he asked. You were scared he would not ask again. The next day, he took you to dinner at Chang's, and your fortune cookie had two strips of paper. Both of them were blank. You knew you had become comfortable when you told him that you watched Jeopardy on the restaurant TV and that you rooted for the following, in this order: women of color, black men, and white women, before finally white men, which meant you never rooted for white men. He laughed and told you he was used to not being rooted for. His mother taught women's studies. And you knew you had become close when you told him that your father was really not a school teacher in Lagos, that he was a junior driver for a construction company. And you told him about that day in Lagos traffic in the rickety Peugeot 504 your father drove. It was raining and your seat was wet because of the rust-eaten hole in the roof. The traffic was heavy. The traffic was always heavy in Lagos. And when it rained, it was chaos. The roads became muddy ponds and cars got stuck and some of your cousins went out and made some money pushing the cars out. The rain, the swampiness, you thought, made your father step on the brakes too late that day. You heard the bump before you felt it. The car your father rammed into was wide, foreign, and dark green with golden headlights like the eyes of a leopard. Your father started to cry and beg even before he got out of the car, and laid himself flat on the road, causing much blowing of horns. Sorry, sir, he chanted. If you sell me and my family, you cannot buy even one tire on your car. Sorry, sir. The big man seated at the back did not come out, but his driver did, examining the damage, looking at your father's sprawled form from the corner of his eye as though the pleading was like pornography, a performance he was ashamed to admit he enjoyed. At last he let your father go, waved him away. The other car's horns blew and drivers cursed. When your father came back into the car, you refused to look at him, because he was just like the pigs that wallowed in the marshes around the market. Your father looked like Nsi. After you told him this, he pursed his lips and held your hand and said he understood how you felt. You shook your hand free, suddenly annoyed, because he thought the world was or ought to be full of people like him. You told him there was nothing to understand. It's just the way it was. He found the African store in the Hartford Yellow Pages and drove you there. Because of the way he walked around with familiarity, tilting the bottle of palm wine to see how much sediment it had, the Ghanaian store owner asked him if he was African, like the white Kenyans or South Africans. And he said yes, but he'd been in America for a long time. He looked pleased that the store owner had believed him. You cooked that evening with the things you had bought, and after he ate gari and onugbu soup, he threw up in your sink. You didn't mind, though, because now you would be able to cook onugbu soup with meat. He didn't eat meat because he thought it was wrong the way they killed animals. He said they released fear toxins into the animals, and the fear toxins made people paranoid. Back home, the meat pieces you ate when there was meat were the size of half your finger. But you did not tell him that. You did not tell him either that the dawa dawa cubes your mother cooked everything with, because curry and thyme were too expensive, had MSG, were MSG. He said MSG caused cancer. It was the reason he liked Chang's. Chang's didn't cook with MSG. Once at Chang's, he told the waiter he had recently visited Shanghai that he spoke some Mandarin. The waiter warmed up and told him what soup was best, and then asked him, "You have girlfriend in Shanghai now?" And he smiled and said nothing. You lost your appetite. The region deep in your chest felt clogged. That night, you didn't moan when he was inside you. And you bit your lips and pretended that you didn't come because you knew he would worry. Later, you told him why you were upset, that even though you went to Chang's so often together, even though you had kissed just before the menus came, the Chinese man had assumed you could not possibly be his girlfriend, and he had smiled and said nothing. Before he apologized, he gazed at you blankly, and you knew that he did not understand. He bought you presents. When you objected about the cost, he said his grandfather in Boston had been wealthy, but hastily added that the old man had given a lot away, and so the trust fund he had wasn't huge. His presence mystified you. A fist-sized glass ball that you shook to watch a tiny, shapely doll in pink spin around. A shiny rock whose surface took on the color of whatever it touched. An expensive scarf hand-painted in Mexico. Finally, you told him, your voice stretched in irony, that in your life, presents were always useful. The rock, for instance, would work if you could grind things with it. He laughed long and hard, but you did not laugh. You realized that in his life, he could buy presents that were just presents and nothing else. Nothing useful. When he started to buy you shoes and clothes and books, you asked him not to. You didn't want any presents at all. He bought them anyway, and you kept them for your cousins and uncles and aunts, for when you would one day be able to visit home, even though you did not know how you could ever afford a ticket and your rent. He said he really wanted to see Nigeria, and he could pay for the both of you to go. You did not want him to pay for you to visit home. You did not want him to go to Nigeria, to add it to the list of countries where he went to gawk at the lives of poor people who could never gawk back at his life. You told him this on a sunny day when he took you to see Long Island Sound, and the two of you argued. Your voices raised as you walked along the calm water. He said you were wrong to call himself righteous. You said he was wrong to call only the poor Indians in Bombay the real Indians. Did it mean he wasn't a real American, since he was not like the poor, fat people you and he had seen in Hartford? He hurried ahead of you, his upper body bare and pale, his flip-flops raising bits of sands. But then he came back. And he held out his hand for yours. You made up and made love and ran your hands through each other's hair, his soft and yellow like the swinging tassels of growing corn, yours dark and bouncy like the filling of a pillow. He had got too much sun and his skin turned the color of a ripe watermelon, and you kissed his back before you rubbed lotion on it. The thing that wrapped itself around your neck, that nearly choked you before you fell asleep, started to loosen, to let go. You knew by people's reactions that you two were abnormal, the way the nasty ones were too nasty and the nice ones too nice. The old white men and women who muttered and glared at him, the black men who shook their heads at you, the black women whose pitying eyes bemoaned your lack of self-esteem, your self-loathing. Or the black women who smiled swift, solidarity smiles. The black men who tried too hard to forgive you, saying a too obvious hi to him. The white men and women who said, what a good-looking pair, too brightly, too loudly, as though to prove their own open-mindedness to themselves. But his parents were different. They almost made you think it was all normal. His mother told you that he had never brought a girl to meet them, except for his high school prom date, and he grinned stiffly and held your hand. The tablecloth shielded your clasped hands. He squeezed your hand, and you squeezed back and wondered why he was so stiff. Why his extra virgin olive oil-colored eyes darkened as he spoke to his parents. His mother was delighted when she asked if you'd read Nawal el-Sadawi, and you said yes. His father asked how similar Indian food was to Nigerian food and teased you about paying when the check came. You looked at them and felt grateful that they did not examine you like an exotic trophy, an ivory tusk. Afterwards, he told you about his issues with his parents, how they portioned out love like a birthday cake, how they would give him a bigger slice if only he'd agree to go to law school. You wanted to sympathize, but instead you were angry. You were angrier when he told you he had refused to go up to Canada with them for a week or two, to their summer cottage in the Quebec countryside. They'd even asked him to bring you. He showed you pictures of the cottage, and you wondered why it was called a cottage, because the buildings that big around your neighborhood back home were banks and churches. You dropped a glass, and it shattered on the hardwood floor of his apartment. And he asked what was wrong, and you said nothing, although you thought a lot was wrong. Later, in the shower, you started to cry. You watched the water dilute your tears, and you didn't know why you were crying. You wrote home, finally, a short letter to your parents, slipped in between the crisp dollar bills, and you included your address. You got a reply only days later by courier. Your mother wrote the letter herself. You knew from the spidery penmanship, from the misspelled words. Your father was dead. He had slumped over the steering wheel of his company car. 5 months now, she wrote. They had used some of the money you sent to give him a good funeral. They killed a goat for the guests and buried him in a good coffin. You curled up in bed, pressed your knees to your chest, and tried to remember what you had been doing when your father died. What you had been doing for all the months when he was already dead. Perhaps your father died on the day your whole body had been covered in goosebumps, hard as uncooked rice, that you could not explain, Juan teasing you about taking over from the chef so that the heat in the kitchen would warm you up. Perhaps your father died on one of the days you took a drive to Mystic, or watched a play in Manchester, or had dinner at Chang's. He held you while you cried, smoothed your hair, and offered to buy your ticket. To go with you to see your family, he said, no, you needed to go alone. He asked if you would come back, and you reminded him that you had a green card and you would lose it if you did not come back in 1 year. He said you knew what he meant. Would you come back? Come back. You turned away and said nothing. And when he drove you to the airport, you hugged him tight for a long, long moment. And then you let go. Thank you.
Condola Rashad read The Thing Around Your Neck by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Greetings to our Selected Shorts podcast audience. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9th, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders.